The host of the following program invites your questions and comments live on air by calling 1-888-678-9597. The phone lines are open now. 1-888-678-9597.
Welcome to Wall Street Unspun with your host, Peter Schiff.
But it's a giant bubble in search of a pin, and it's going to find one.
Are you confused with the ups and downs of the economy and what it means to you?
Don't believe the propaganda, and that's what it is. When you're listening to an analyst on a lot of these popular financial shows, you're not getting investment advice. You're getting propaganda.
Get ready to untangle the web of misinformation provided by the mainstream media.
These firms are trying to sell you stocks. Their real clients, their banking clients, are trying to get rid of stuff.
And now, here's your host of Wall Street Unspun, the president of Euro Pacific Capital and a licensed broker with a passion for truth. It's Wall Street Unspun with Peter Schiff.
Oh, hey, everybody. It's Peter Schiff. I said last week that I would be out of the country today and unable to do the radio show, but I actually happen to be in Miami. I have a stopover between Belize, where I was, and Anguilla, where I'm going. I'm actually in Miami for the night, so I thought I'd be able to do the show. I know Michael Pinto was going to do the show in my absence, but I figured I'd do it myself since I'm in the country. And this is the second to last Wall Street Unspun. As I mentioned on our last show, next Wednesday is going to be the last episode of Wall Street Unspun, and I am going to be starting a brand new daily radio show that will be Monday through Friday from 6 to 8 p.m. Eastern Time, 5 days a week. And it will be on internet. If you want to hear the show, though, we will not be putting the show up on the Europac site the way we do now. It'll be on a separate site, shiftradio.com. I don't think anything is on that URL right now, so I don't think you can go to it now, but it will be up before the show starts, shiftradio.com. And that's where you'll go to listen live on the internet. And also, if you want to listen to the shows that you may have missed, that's where you go, shiftradio.com. I'm also going to be moving over all of the Wall Street Unspun archives. I'm going to take them, I think, off the Europac site, since there will no longer be a radio show on the site. So I'm going to take all of those archives and move them over, I believe, to the other server, so they'll be hosted by Shift Radio. Now, if for some reason I can't do that, then I'll leave them at Europac. But it didn't make any sense to just have archives of the shows when I'm not doing any new shows. And I probably figure get all the radio content on one site. So make sure and tune in next week to hear live the very last Wall Street Unspun, which I've been doing for almost 6 years, 5.5 years. And basically all the advice that I've been giving, everything, all the warnings that I've been giving are really playing out right now. I mean, this is the early stages of the ultimate collapse, but we are seeing that right now. Well, first, let me just give you guys a number to call, 888-678-9597, 888-678-9597. For those of you, if you're following it, since I did this show last week, we've had a huge increase in the price of gold, the price of silver, record highs. Yesterday alone, I think gold was up $25 an ounce. It was up another 10 today, but it's been up almost every day since I did this show last week. So the spot market is around 1320. I know the December futures are over 1350. Spot silver is almost $23 an ounce. I mean, this is the highest it's been since the Hunts tried to corner the market when it went up to $50 back around 1980. Copper prices keep hitting a new multi-year high. On the currency front, the Swiss franc is now worth more than $1.04. This is a new all-time record high for the Swiss franc. It's never been this high. The Japanese yen hit a new 15-year high today, and that's despite all that big intervention. Imagine where the yen would be right now if Japan had not intervened to prop up the dollar. The Australian and New Zealand dollars, despite the fact that the Australian Central Bank the other day did not raise interest rates as was expected, that currency is at a new 52-week high, as is the New Zealand dollar at a new 52-week high. I think these currencies are headed for, you know, much more than 52-week highs. The Australian dollar is just 3 cents below parity. It's worth about 97, or actually closer, probably 97.5 cents. The Canadian dollar is even closer to parity. It's just about 99 cents. So, for a while I thought the Australian dollar might beat the Canadian dollar to parity. But right now it looks like it'll be tough. I thought Australia might have come from behind. I think both will cross the parity line and continue to gain. In fact, I think even the New Zealand dollar, which is now about 75 cents, will be at parity with the U.S. dollar. Not this year, but I think it's got a shot at doing it by next year. And, of course, it could go a lot higher than that. Based on what's going on. The dollar index right now is trading with a 77 handle. The spot index is below 77.50. So the dollar index has now dropped 12% since its highs in June. We are going, we're about 10% off an all-time record low in the dollar index, which I still believe we have a shot of taking out this year. But if we don't take it out in 2010, I'm confident that we will take it out early in 2011. Now, what's going on right now is, you're having the dollar is finally reacting to the problems that have been building. When I was warning about the unraveling of the U.S. economy, when I wrote the book Crash Proof, the ultimate crash that I believed was coming was going to be centered around a dollar crisis. That dollar crisis hasn't hit yet, but I think it is still coming. You remember, if you go back and reread, Crash Proof, I wrote about the bursting of the housing bubble. I wrote about the collapse of the subprime market, the collapse of Fannie and Freddie and banks, and this huge recession as being the pin that would ultimately prick the bubble. And the way I described how the ultimate crash would pan out, it was that the economy would not die of the disease. It wasn't going to be the ramifications of the bursting of the housing bubble per se, the bankruptcies, the foreclosures, the recession. That wasn't what I was afraid of. My real fear was what the government was going to do in response, that it wasn't the disease that was going to kill us, but the government cure. And that is precisely the way I believe it is playing out right now. Because I wrote that what was going to happen was that the Fed and the government were going to try to stimulate the economy, they were going to try to reflate the housing bubble, they were going to try to bail people out, and that was going to kill the dollar. And I wrote and I warned that the biggest losers were not going to be the people who bought houses. People loaned money to people to buy houses, and maybe not because they don't get paid back, but because they get paid back in money of depreciated value. And I warned that even people who had nothing to do with the buying and selling or lending for houses, people who had done the right things all their lives, people who had put money aside, people who had built savings in government bonds or CDs, or people who had a pension, fixed annuities that they had purchased, these are going to be the biggest casualties of this currency war. This war of self-destruction, that the dollar, when it collapses, that is the real crisis. And I think that is what's coming. I know the fact that initially in 2008, as the problem first surfaced, the knee-jerk reaction was this rally in the dollar. And everybody was saying, oh, you see, look, Peter Schiff talked about, crash proof. And look, his clients' accounts crashed. Well, the collapse that I was preparing my clients for didn't occur yet. I think it's occurring now. I think it's early on. That was those are the events that were to set the crash in motion. Same thing with, most foreign stocks. I mean, the dollar has never been this low. I mean, if you look at the Swiss franc, I said the Swiss franc is at a all-time record high. But if you look at what happened to the Swiss franc in 2008, the Swiss franc went from about 97 cents at the beginning of 2008, all the way down to 86 cents. I mean, not that huge a drop, but a pretty decent drop. And then, of course, Swiss stocks went down. But now the Swiss franc is at 104, so it's higher than it's been. If you look at any other currency, I mean, look at the New Zealand dollar. Look at the decline that it had in 2008. I think it went from about where it is now, all the way down to, I think, about maybe 50 cents. And now it's come all the way back, more than 50% to be higher than it was, before. So those, you know, those paper losses have by and large been recouped. But the real crash, I believe, is ahead, the collapse of the dollar, because the dollar is going to collapse, I think, based on everything the government did wrong in 2008 and 2009, and everything that they continue to do wrong, because the government refuses to allow the economy to correct the imbalances, because it's too painful for our elected leaders to allow the market to try to transition from the bubble economy that still exists, where we spend money we don't have and buy things that we can't afford and didn't make, to go into a real economy where people save money and we underconsume and we make capital investments and we grow businesses and produce products. You know, none of that's going to happen with all these regulations and all these taxes and 0% interest rates. So now that all that stimulus is out there and all these losses have been, you know, absorbed by governments and central banks, we are experiencing the next leg down, the bigger leg, the real crash. And I think, you know, we'll see if that happens next year in 2011 when we get a currency crisis, when we get a sovereign debt crisis. And I think that, you know, in the Fed's efforts to try to keep long-term interest rates down, and of course they hit new lows today. I think that the 10-year, this is the lowest it's been. The 10-year yield is just below 2.4%. And the 30-year yield is 3.66%. But the only reason that yields are like this is because the Fed is out there saying that it's going to buy bonds. It's going to have more quantitative easing. The Fed is going to print money and buy bonds. And so bond prices are rising because the Fed's going to be in there buying them. But the problem is the way the Fed buys. The Fed doesn't buy the way I buy or the way you buy. The Fed buys bonds by printing new money, creating money that didn't exist, buying bonds, taking bonds off the market, and putting money into the market. So the Fed creates inflation to buy bonds, which is the worst thing for bonds. And in fact, if you're going to buy a 10-year bond right now that's yielding 2.4%, I mean, does anybody? How could the inflation rate not average 2.4% for the next 10 years? And of course, you have to pay income taxes when you buy these bonds. So even if inflation is 1.5%, or you know, after taxes, the yield is zero. So obviously, but what the Federal Reserve is going to have to do is, if they want to keep interest rates this low, which they want to do, right, to keep this phony economy going, to keep all the debtors solvent, they've got to keep these rates low so they can afford to pay the interest, but whether it's the federal government, whether it's individual homeowners, or, you know, the banks. I mean, the banks, the only way the banks can stay solvent right now is to borrow money for free from the Fed, because they're turning around and reloaning it at such low rates. So they have to keep this game going. But what's going to happen is, as the dollar weakens and weakens, more people are going to want to start selling bonds, right? And eventually the pressure is going to come on bonds. And now the Fed is going to have to buy even more bonds. I mean, right now there probably are some speculators that are buying bonds because they're planning on flipping them to the Fed. But at some point, that's not going to happen anymore, and there won't be any buyers other than the Fed. And then when that happens, the Fed's going to have to pretty much buy all the treasuries that are out there, because they're the only ones that will be dumb enough to buy them, because, of course, nobody would buy them with real money. But the Fed doesn't care, because it's buying them with funny money. But the problem is, if they start printing all this money to buy treasuries, and the inflation rate is obviously higher, and people start to realize that inflation is running at much, much more than the yields on bonds, nobody's going to want to buy corporate bonds. No one's going to want to buy muni bonds. So then you're going to have a big discrepancy where you have really, really low yields on treasuries, but corporate bonds, municipal bonds, those yields are skyrocketing. Now, the Fed can't let that happen, right, because that'll crush the economy. So now what's the Fed going to do? Now the Fed's going to start buying corporate bonds or municipal bonds. The Fed's going to have to start buying all bonds. And, of course, that means they print even more money, and that destroys the value of the dollar even faster, and it's a self-perpetuating spiral that leads to the hyperinflation, which I think is coming. And the only way to avoid the hyperinflation is for the Fed to raise interest rates, stop buying these securities, and let the recession finally run its course. Of course, the recession that we have today, or depression, is going to be much worse than the one that we would have had the government not made all these mistakes in the first place. But because we bailed everybody out, because we stimulated, because we had quantitative easing, we have dug ourselves into a much deeper hole. Now, the alternative is we never do the right thing because doing the right thing is so painful, and we end up with runaway or hyperinflation, and we turn the dollar into monopoly money. And there is a very, very real probability that that is precisely what is going to happen. But I think that even best case scenario, if we do the right thing, it's not going to be until a lot more damage is done to the dollar and to the economy. And as I said, when I wrote, Crash Proof, I thought that the dollar index would go down to about 40, right? That was what my forecast was. And, you know, right now it is at 77. So it's still a long way to go to 40. I actually think at this point, given the severity, you know, the enormity of what they've done, 40 is really an optimistic best case scenario. I'd be surprised if the dollar index only went to 40. It more likely might go to 30 or 20. I mean, and this is complete destruction for the dollar. I mean, if the dollar index went to 20, that would mean all other currencies would basically, triple against the dollar. So where would oil be? I mean, oil right now is still kind of lagging. Oil's at $83 a barrel. I mean, this is the highest it's been in quite some time. But, I mean, where would oil be if the dollar index, you know, went down there? Oil would be at least $200 a barrel, maybe more, maybe $300 a barrel. Obviously it wouldn't be that much more expensive for other people in other countries because, you know, their currencies would have gone up. So, $300 a barrel oil, if your currency tripled, is not much higher than it is right now for the rest of the world. But, of course, for Americans, it's a disaster. And, of course, it's not just going to be oil that's going up. It's going to be other commodities as well. I mean, look at the CRB index is up around 290 right now. It's, the chart looks really good for the CRB. In fact, if you make a point of watching my video blog, I did a video blog on Friday on YouTube on Schiff Report. Because, of course, September was the best September for stocks in 71 years, right? Because the stock market returned about, 7-8% or so during the month of September. I pointed out in that video blog how many things beat the stock market in the month of September. How many commodities, in particular silver, oil, cotton, sugar, corn, soybeans. There are so many things that went up more than the stock market, despite the fact that it had its best September in 71 years. And the appropriate conclusion to make is not that the stock market is rising. It's that the dollar is falling. And so everything is going up in price because everything has to go up in price when the currency that you're pricing things in is losing value. And that's all that's happening. It's just that the stock market is not rising fast enough as fast as these other commodities. And I think that will continue to be the case. I mean, even the Australian dollar beat the U.S. market for the month of September. So if somebody just stuffed Australian dollars in their mattress, they had a better return than stocks, even though U.S. stocks had their best September in 71 years. That tells you the degree to which the dollar is being destroyed. And imagine how much weaker the dollar would be if foreign central banks weren't intervening to prop it up. I mean, it is on life support. How much longer will it be before they pull the plug? How much longer will the world keep interest rates this low? We've got interest rates at zero. We have this terrible monetary policy, and the rest of the world is following our lead. It's like you've got a classroom, and everybody is cheating off the same person, but they're all cheating off the stupidest person in the class. So, of course, they're all going to fail. At some point, the world's going to realize that they cannot keep their interest rates at zero and debase their currencies just to keep them from rising against the dollar. They have to surrender in this currency war. They have to realize that they're committing Harry Carey by fighting this war. And when they call it off and they start raising their rates, what's going to happen to the dollar? And you get countries, Japan is worried that it's the yen is weak, it's too strong. It's not too strong. It's rising against one currency, the dollar. It's not rising against other currencies. It's not a question of yen strength. The yen isn't really strong. It's the dollar that's weak. And when the Japanese or the Czech figure this out, that they've got to detether their currencies from the Titanic currency of the U.S. dollar. At some point, they will figure out they can't do that. They, what they have to do in these other countries is take the hit. It's not nearly as big, as bad as the hit we're going to take in restructuring their economies away from exports to America. They have to recognize that their biggest customer is broke, cannot afford their products, and they need to find other customers, either in their own countries or in other countries, or they need to retool their factories and change the mix of the products that they're making. Instead of making products that Americans want, make products that somebody else wants, because Americans may want them, but we can't afford them. So, you know, but again, the politicians in these other countries don't want to make the difficult choices because it does impact some of their constituents who are political donors who benefit from this status quo. But it is going to happen because, as I said, the cost to the world of propping up the dollar is increasing every day, and it's not going to be too long. And it could be next year where this happens. And again, this is the ultimate crash that I am worried about. The economic collapse that I'm worrying about is the collapse of the dollar reserve status, the collapse of our phony economy, a collapse of our bond market. This is what I've been preparing people for years, not just in 2008. When I was giving people investment advice in 2002, 2003, 2004, this is what I was preparing people for. It was this long-term eventuality that I could see coming from miles away. Now, it would have been better if I could have accurately forecast, every little, a turn. I mean, it would have been nice to have said, when the whole thing hits the fan, we're going to get this huge dollar rally. So we'll wait and we won't buy any foreign stocks. We won't buy any, we'll buy all this stuff. And, I'm not clairvoyant. But I knew enough at the time. I knew enough in 2008, early 2009, when the dollar had strengthened, when commodities had fallen, when gold had fallen. I knew enough to know that it was a head fake. I knew enough to know that all we needed to do is not change our strategy, but just double down. Just take whatever extra cash we had and increase our bet, because I knew that we had the winning hand and we had an opportunity to back it up with more money because of the circumstances that really enabled to the mother of all gift horses, where we had opportunities that we were fortunate enough to have had, because so many people rushed to the wrong conclusion at the same time. And that's really what happened. And again, it's because so many people don't understand the problem. They never understood the problem. They didn't understand it before 2008, and they still don't understand it after 2008. That's why so many people out there actually think the stimulus is going to work. They think it's going to work because they don't understand the disease. They don't understand what's the cure is. You know, there are people are saying that, the market's going to go up regardless. You know, if there's good economic news, the market goes up. And if there's bad economic news, the market goes up because the Fed's going to fix the problem with quantitative easing. Well, it's not that the Fed's going to fix the problem. The Fed's going to make the problem worse with quantitative easing. But it is good for stocks, because when you destroy the value of money, the price of everything goes up, including stocks. And so when people are buying stocks on bad news, at least the real money, it's not because they think the Fed's going to fix the economy. It's because they think the Fed's going to destroy the dollar. And so they'd rather own stocks than dollars. That is what's happening. And, and that will continue to happen. I just, wanted to give one quick word, too, before I take the calls. Again, just to remind everybody of what's the purpose of my trip, and that I'm going offshore to set up a business offshore that I'd rather do onshore. But, this type of outsourcing is something that I've resisted for a long time, and I'm finally throwing in the towel. The regulators make it so difficult to grow my business, to expand my business, to do the things that I want to do in the interest of my clients that, I'm tired of fighting. And rather than fighting, I'm just going to go and open up a new company out of the country where I don't have these kind of obstacles. I don't have these kind of hurdles. I can grow a business. I can provide a valuable service to clients. I can provide employment opportunity to people who live outside the United States. And I can make some money for myself. And, of course, whenever somebody wants to grow a business and expand a business, they're not doing it because, it's a charitable endeavor. I mean, everybody is trying to create more wealth for themselves, their families. And the government is making it very difficult. I mean, I was basically looking at a situation where I was thinking about retiring or continuing to build a business. And I'm 47. I didn't feel like retiring. I wanted to continue to build a business. I thought I could have grown my Euro Pacific Capital business into a much, much larger brokerage firm. But instead, you know, I'm gonna try to grow a foreign company. And, you know, the foreign company is going to concentrate on non-Americans. It's not going to work with American citizens, but there are far more people that live abroad than live in America. And, you know, rather than building up a large American firm that handles international accounts, I am going to build up an international firm that handles international accounts. And I'm going to do a lot of the things that I wanted to do in America using American labor and paying taxes in America. These are things that I wanted to do, but instead I am not going to do it. So I'm going to be paying taxes in other countries. I'm going to be making capital investments in other countries. I'm going to be hiring people in other countries instead of hiring them here in America. And I know that I'm not the only person doing this, but you can look at the rationale. The rationale is purely economic. It's to get out from under regulations and taxes that are strangling me, and other businesses have already done that. I mean, so many jobs, so much has been outsourced because we are uncompetitive, because our government makes us uncompetitive. And, you know, and so this is going to continue to happen. At the same time, we're printing money, so we're destroying our economy, we're destroying the jobs, we're chasing the capital and labor out of the country, and we're printing money. I mean, this is a huge, huge disaster in the making, and we are witnessing it. You know, we have, you know, front row tickets to this event, and, you know, in the history books, they're going to be talking about, or we're going to be reading about, people will be reading about the collapse of America, and this is the time period in which it collapsed, and we are living there. Anyway, let me go to the phones. First up is Steve, who's here in Florida, where I happen to be myself. Go ahead, Steve. Steve, are you there?
Oh, how you doing, Peter?
Good.
I saw you the other day on the Kudlow Report, and I know you've touched on stocks going up because of the devaluing of the dollar. I can't really grasp the concept behind the dollar devaluing and the, you know, the stock market running up. I would think the exact opposite was happening. So I'm just trying to understand if you can kind of explain it, you know, and also...
Well, it's really simple. You know, when you're pricing stocks, right, it's how much is the stock worth in dollars relative to the dollar. So if the currency loses value, right, let's say the dollar lost half its value, stocks would have to double in price to maintain the same value. It wouldn't mean that they went up. They just would have, you know, stayed even. So what's happening is prices for stocks are rising to reflect the fact that the dollar that we're using to measure the stock has gone up. It's like if a ruler has 12 inches in it, and right now I'm basically 6 feet tall. But if you decide to redefine a ruler, and the ruler has 6 inches in it instead of 12 inches, well, then I'm 12 feet tall. See, I've doubled in height because the size of the ruler is smaller. There's now 6 inches to a foot instead of 12. But I'm not really any taller. I can't dunk a basketball now because this new ruler says I'm 12 feet tall. But I'm 12 feet tall because we shrunk the ruler. So when you make the dollar smaller, you're making the ruler smaller. And so when you measure the stocks, the stock prices are bigger. You follow?
Yeah, I understand what you're saying. You expect
the other reason is, as people start to realize that the dollar is going to be destroyed, they want to own real things, and stocks represent real things. You know, if you owned shares in stocks in Germany, in Weimar Republic, if you owned shares of, I don't know, Mercedes or whatever was around back then, BMW, if you owned stock in one of these companies, you didn't get wiped out. The people who owned bonds got wiped out. The people who had, you know, marks in the bank got wiped out. But the values of stocks were there because they were real companies. So in a highly inflationary time period, you want to own real stocks. Now, in real terms, the stocks might not really be delivering a great return, but they're not going to be delivering as bad a return as bonds or cash. So people want to get rid of cash and bonds and hold something real, which is stocks. But that's why if you look at the stocks that are doing the best, it's commodity stocks or it's the gold stocks. So it's not, you don't just buy stocks at random. Try to figure out which stocks, you know, have the best real value and buy those.
Yeah, do you expect the market to continue going up at this point?
Well, I do. I mean, it won't go up in a straight line. There will be pullbacks, but I think it's going to continue to rise in terms. But I think it's going to fall in gold terms. I mean, right now the market is kind of hanging in there. It's still worth about 8.3 ounces of gold. I mean, I expect the market to fall sharply in terms of gold. It kind of hasn't, really. I mean, gold prices have been going up about the same pace as the stock market, maybe a little bit faster, but not much so. But I expect that to change. I expect to see the gold price moving up a lot faster than the stock market.
Yeah. Now,
and I expect, I do expect, and this is only my opinion, I think the gold stocks, I mean, I mentioned that the gold stocks just hit a new high. They took out the high for March of 2008. But, I mean, they're above that high by about 1%. The gold price is above its March 08 high by more than 30%. So we've seen a 30% plus rise in the value of gold, but only a 1% or so rise in the value of the stocks that mine that gold. I think that these stocks are still much too cheap, and I think it's a reflection of the lack of speculation in this gold market. That for all the talk about a bubble, to me it looks like a bull market climbing a wall of worry. And there's a lot of people worried. There's more people worried than are buying, you know.
And, you know, I know you, in the past you've talked about the price of what it costs to mine the gold, which I guess is between, you know, $450-$500 or so. Does that worry you that, you know, as gold becomes expensive, you know, when it turns to $2,000 or $3,000 an ounce or something like that, do you believe that that'll have any impact on the topping out of the, you know, the price of gold?
Yeah, no, I mean, obviously, as the price of gold goes up and up and up, more people will be looking to mine gold. I mean, more people will be opening up gold mines, looking for gold, and, you know, it'll bring more supply on. But it's going to take a long time. Look, I mean, I was on a Fox show the other day, and there was a town that was reporting a big increase in people coming in panning. You know, a lot of unemployed people are panning for gold these days. So, you know, more people are going to become prospectors, and more people are going to be looking for gold. So, obviously, we're going to have more supply. But, you know, bringing on gold supply ain't easy. You know, gold is money for a reason. It's scarce. It is hard to find, and it's expensive to mine. So it's not like the supply is going to shoot up to meet that demand. The way I think that the demand is going to be met is with higher prices. See, the way that there's going to be enough gold for everybody who wants it is for the price to be a lot higher. So that way when people buy gold, they just don't need to buy as much. And I think that's how supply and demand are going to meet at much, much higher prices, which is why I own a lot of it myself and why I've been, you know, so insistent that people buy gold and gold mining stocks for, you know, over the years.
Okay. I appreciate your, you're talking to me, and I wish you luck with your show. You know, I'm glad to hear that you're going to be on five nights a week. I think that's going to be helpful.
Well, the country needs it. Hopefully I can educate somebody. Maybe somebody in Washington will listen, you know, before it's too late.
It'd be nice. You know, I'd like to see things turn around. I mean, I'm not betting on the government. You know, I'm betting against them at this point. But I'd love to see something change in this country for sure.
All right. Thanks a lot, Steve.
Take care, Peter.
Okay, Peter on the line from Connecticut. Go ahead, Peter.
Oh, hi. I had a little bit of time this week. I was listening to some of your old interviews with the mortgage brokers. And one thing I was confused about, you said, at the end, the interest rates will rise rapidly to keep people from owning U.S. dollars. But why couldn't the Fed just continue with quantitative easing 5 and just they be the buyers of last resort rather than keeping?
Yeah,
people...
I mean that's what I spoke about earlier in the show was that is the direction we're moving in is that the Fed has a printing press so it can buy bonds from everybody who wants to sell. And it can keep interest rates low. But doing that will destroy the value of money. I mean, absolutely destroy it. And that's worse than letting interest rates rise.
So
you know, what good is it if you can borrow a lot of money, but you can't buy anything with the money? It has no value.
Right. And then one other thing, and this is just from the Fordham debate, and this has always been a point that I try and make, is that if the government guarantees an asset, that they must at least try and regulate it.
This is the thing where, you know, two wrongs make a right, or they don't make a right, but they just mitigate the damage. I mean, in a free market, we don't need government regulation, right? Because the market will regulate. But when government comes in and guarantees something, then you remove the market regulation. There is no market regulation when there's a government guarantee. So the minute the government guarantees something, now the government has to regulate to undo the damage that was caused by its guarantee. So
well,
I am never against, once the government guarantees something, I want a lot of regulations. I would prefer no guarantee and no regulations. But what some people want on Wall Street is they want the guarantee, but then they advocate for free market capitalism. And then when it collapses, we give free market capitalism a bad name because it's not free markets. If there's a government guarantee, there's nothing free at all. There's no capitalism at all.
Correct. I completely agree. Good talking to you.
All right. Thanks for the call, Peter.
Okay, thanks. Bye-bye.
Next up is Michael in New Jersey. Go ahead, Mike.
Hey, Pete, how are you? Long-time listener. Well, actually, just recently, maybe a year or two ago. I was curious about Bloomberg articles that I've read as recently as June and last month, where on one hand, you say that, you know, we can't continue to keep borrowing in perpetuity. The Chinese are going to figure out that we can't pay them back. But yet the Bloomberg articles that I'm reading are saying that they're not just buying short-term notes and T-bills, as you've said before. They're actually buying 30-year bonds, that they're actually buying more treasuries. That was back in June. And then it shot up again where foreign investors are actually, again, buying more bonds. So my question to you is that do you think that it's something more than just monetary gain? For instance, my credit card company doesn't want me to pay them back. They want to keep me on the hook because I'm a revenue stream. Do you think that that may be a reason why the Chinese and foreign investors are actually buying more bonds than notes?
Look, I don't actually know, you know, the amount of bonds that they're buying. I haven't seen that. Maybe you can send it to me. I haven't read any article about that. I mean, it's been my assumption that they're smart enough not to buy the bonds and that they're buying the short-term stuff, and it's kind of the Fed or some of our financial institutions that have been buying the longer-term paper, that their goal is just to prop up the dollar, not to prop up, you know, the Treasury market. But the reason that they're doing it, it is vendor financing. I mean, they want to keep selling us stuff, but they're not actually selling us anything. They're pretending to sell us because we're not paying. But for the companies that are actually selling the stuff, they are getting paid because they're pushing the bill onto the Chinese citizens who are being forced to pay for the products that the Americans can't really afford. Meanwhile, the Chinese don't get to consume. They, you know, their purchasing power is stolen by their government and given to Americans who then use it to buy these products that, absent these subsidies, the Chinese would have bought. So it's all politics. I think it is going to change, you know, and, you know, this is the time period because we are upping the ante, right, of how much it is going to cost. You know, the world cannot have 300 million people that live off of everybody else. And that is, you know, that is where we're going. Look at the number of people who are permanently unemployed and getting checks from the government. Look at the people who are going to be collecting Social Security and who are going to be collecting Social Security. Look at all the people who are going to put on government health insurance. Look at all the government employees. I mean, the China and Japan, and they can't keep paying all these bills. You know, you can't expect the taxpayers in China to pay for all the pensions of retired U.S. government workers, all active U.S. government workers, state government workers, you know, state retirees, Social Security. I mean, the world is not going to do that. I mean, it's going to stop. And I think that we are asking for such a huge amount of money. You know, I mean, there's a good chance that, you know, they're going to extend the Bush tax cuts, which means, you know, we're not going to raise taxes the way we originally planned, which means the budget deficit is going to be that much bigger because, of course, there's no government spending that's going to be cut. So we're not going to raise taxes. We're going to keep increasing spending, and we're going to expect the Chinese to supply the difference. I mean,
wow. Oh, sorry, one other thing. I just finished reading How an Economy Grows and Why It Crashes, great book. I'm now reading a little book of Bull Moves. The question I wanted to ask is that I do understand we need to get out of the dollar. I'm buying gold and I'm buying Australian dollars and so on. But I'm just a little confused because we kind of need dollars to get into foreign stocks. So, for instance,
Well, you don't need them. You actually need the other currencies. So when one of my clients sends me dollars in order to buy a stock, let's say in Australia, we first have to take their U.S. dollars and buy Australian dollars, because we go to the Australian Stock Exchange and buy a stock, the seller expects to get paid in Australian dollars. So that's what happens.
Right, but then at some point, as long as he's here in America, and I even saw you say this, I think, on the Money Show or some tape, some show you had recorded on your site, ultimately you have to convert those orders back to American dollars here for your clients, right?
Well, when they want the money. So if I have a client that wants, you know, monthly income so that he can, you know, pay his rent or buy food, yeah, then we would convert it back to U.S. dollars. But the thing is, as the U.S. dollar is losing value, then those checks get bigger and bigger and bigger, because each time we go to convert their foreign currencies into dollars, we get more and more dollars. And that's what helps you pay for the higher costs, right? When cost of living is going up 10% a month, but your dividends are going up by that same amount, you can afford the higher cost of living. The problem is the American citizen who didn't get his money abroad, who didn't buy foreign stocks, who has a fixed income in dollars, his cost of living is going up, but the number of dollars he gets every month remains the same. And so he's getting wiped out. Next up is Paul from Vermont.
Hi, Peter. Thanks for taking my call.
Good. Thanks for calling. What's up?
Well, I had two quick questions for you. The first is, whenever I try and defend a gold standard, people are always telling me, oh, you know, things were so much worse before then. And
no,
I just
weren't.
Really find that I'm pretty illiterate on that. And I was wondering, first of all, if you could recommend you know, maybe a good historical account of what, you know, economy
was like
during
the gold standard. Because the whole idea that, you know, that things were terrible while we're on a gold standard is just absolutely nonsense. I mean, we were on a gold standard, first of all, until 1971. But, you know, it wasn't as good. You know, we kind of moved away from it during the Depression. Mm-hmm. And so it wasn't ideal. But the purest gold standard that we were on, really, was between, you know, the end of the Civil War and the beginning of the First World War, from like 1865 to 1913, right? That was the purest gold standard that we were on during the history of this country. And that was the most prosperous period of time for the history of this country. That's when GDP grew the most. That's when living standards rose the fastest. That's when we had the entire Industrial Revolution. That's when we moved our country from, you know, an agrarian economy to an industrial economy. I mean, the performance of the economy between that period of time. And I said, if somebody were to fall asleep like a Van Winkle kind of guy in 1865, and he woke up in 1913, he would not even recognize the country. He would be in awe, because he would have fallen asleep when people were, using outhouses to go to the bathroom. They were reading by candlelight. They were riding on horses. Everybody was working in the farm. People didn't live much different than they did hundreds of years before. And then all of a sudden, bring him to 1913. I mean, people—you've got people riding around in cars, living in houses with electricity, with indoor plumbing, with refrigeration. I mean, people are—the whole country. People are working in factories. They're producing, appliances. I mean, the whole country was different. I mean, you wouldn't even. It was a huge leap. I mean, meanwhile, if you take all that's happened since then to now. I mean, it's not nearly as big a deal, even with more time. I mean, we've got television sets, we've got cell phones, but they had telephones back then in 1913. I mean, the difference between having no phone and having a telephone, the difference between a cell phone and a landline is not as big as the difference between a landline and having to write a letter. I mean, that's what you had to do in 1865. If you wanted to communicate with somebody, you know, you had to write them a letter, and it might take you a week or two. You know, before you heard back from him. So, you know, we did great under a gold standard. Our standard of living, the average person life improved so much more under a gold standard. You know, what's thrived under a paper standard is government. Government has been able to grow dramatically off the gold standard. So it's the bureaucracy has benefited. The government, the size and the power of the federal government has grown enormously because we're not on the gold standard. So if you're a proponent of big government, if you want government power and government control, then you don't want a gold standard, because a gold standard is lousy for big government, because you can't get a big government with a gold standard, because there's no, they can't print their, they can't finance it with a printing press.
Right. Good. Yeah,
it's all a bunch of revisionist history. It's all a bunch of nonsense, you know.
Yeah.
And believe me, what we're going through now, there is no precedent for this. This is going to be the worst economic disaster in U.S. history, and it's happening on a fiat standard, and it would have been impossible under a gold standard. Mm-hmm. Anyway, thanks for the call.
Well, I got one quick question for you, Peter.
Yeah.
Second part. You know, often you say that you think there's a bubble in bonds, and I was wondering if you feel like that applies for foreign bonds as well, or only dollar-denominated bonds.
No, I don't think it's a bubble in all bonds. I mean, certainly, like, Japanese bonds look like a bubble to me. And so I think you do have some bubbles around the world in bonds, but in some markets it's not really a bubble, but they might be overpriced. I do expect long-term interest rates to rise worldwide. And so I don't think that long-term bonds are good investments in any currency. So for my clients who want to buy, you know, bonds, I usually try to buy shorter duration bonds, so that if interest rates do rise a lot, that you don't have a big hit like you would in long-term bonds. And that's one of the other reasons I prefer dividend-paying equities for people who need income. I think there's too much risk in long-term bonds. I would rather assume the risk of stocks and get paid dividends on stocks than go out far on the yield curve and tie myself up for a relatively low yield for an extended period of time.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Sure. Thanks for the call. Next up is Peter in Nevada. How you doing, Peter?
Hey, Peter. How you doing?
Good.
I have a question about silver.
Uh-huh.
I've been buying silver through the futures market because of the leverage that it allows me. At what point, at what price should I say, would silver have to go to before I should think about selling all the futures and buying physical silver so I can avoid any kind of default? I like the leverage that I'm getting. One-to-one ratio on physical silver wouldn't give me as much money as the futures
yeah,
market.
Yeah, I mean,
at some
I have
point,
no
I would have
idea,
to, yeah, right?
you know how to answer that question. I think you should have physical silver. I mean, one of the problems, too, is when you have the futures contracts, you're paying taxes every year, even if you haven't sold. Because you market to market, and you have to pay taxes each year. So at least if you own this physical silver, you're not getting taxed every year. You don't get taxed until you sell. So it's good to actually own some actual silver.
Well, I was going to take all the profits from the futures and buy 100% physical silver, but I was waiting. You know, I want to keep riding this up, and you know, before it gets at the point where.
Yeah, I think that's better than just pyramiding it up, because you run. Sometimes people try to pyramid their profits by buying more, and then what happens is you get a correction and it wipes you out. But if you're just booking your profits in physical silver, I think that's a much safer way to speculate with it, you know, because you're basically taking your chips off the table, but they're not completely off the table because they're still in silver, but they're not, you're not adding to your leverage.
Okay. Now, do you see the counterparty risk coming in the next year, or do you think it's
now? I don't know when the counterparty risk comes in, and apparently I was on this show on Fox, and this guy was trying to describe to me why there's no way the exchange could ever default because all the various FCMs guarantee it. And I mean, I don't know. I still think that there's counterparty risk, and I think that there's going to be some problems when all of a sudden all these commodities are moving limit up or more a day, and the shorts just, you know, don't have the money. And, you know, if a lot of things could happen. I think that when people think there's no risk because everybody is solvent, I mean, maybe there will be no counterparty risk because maybe the federal government will bail everybody out. You know, maybe if anybody fails, the feds will be there, you know.
Also, natural gas hasn't participated in the commodity bull run. Do you see that changing pretty soon?
Yeah, you know, apparently there's a pretty good supply of natural gas right now, and that's keeping the price down. So we need to work off that supply, which I'm sure will happen. And, you know, the low price will keep production offline. And, you know, so I still have a lot of companies with exposure to natural gas, and I'm still bullish on natural gas. So it's just, you know, it's just a question of time, but I think it's going to go up.
Okay. All right.
Well, thanks for the call.
All right. Bye.
Yeah, particularly as oil really starts to become expensive and people start trying to trade out, you know, trade off and use less oil and more natural gas, that'll take up some of the supply that's around. Let's see. Next up is Jim in Texas. Go ahead, Jim.
Yes, this is Jim from San Antonio. I've been a Euro Pacific Capital investor for about 3 years out of the Phoenix office with John Cataldo.
Okay, so you came in and you had a pretty bit of a wild ride because you came in, you know, and then relatively before the collapse.
Yeah, yeah. My question, at the beginning of today's program, you started talking about how you're going offshore and been opening up a part of your company or a company to address foreign investors. Can U.S. investors take advantage of this, or how will we be affected?
U.S. investors will not be affected. I mean, what I'm trying to do is split my company up. My initial idea was Euro Pacific Capital would transact for everybody. So if somebody wanted to open up an account with me and they lived in Europe or Asia, I would have them open up the account at Euro Pacific Capital. But what I'm trying to do is make Euro Pacific Capital smaller because it's just, you know, all the regulations are so cumbersome. So I'm going to set up another company outside the United States so that if somebody from another country wants to do business with me, they don't do business with me in America, they do business with me offshore. That way I can provide those services without all these regulations. And so it's going to be a lot easier for me to compete and grow my business with less regulation and lower taxes. And I'm also going to do other things offshore that I would have done onshore. Asset management, I'll be doing some investment banking, I'm going to have research analysts that are going to be offshore. I'm going to start to do a lot of things in my company because the regulations are a lot less onerous, so it's a lot easier for me to do what I need to do.
But
these are all things that I would have preferred to have done in the United States. But as far as American customers, nothing is going to change. So if you're a Euro Pacific Capital client, you're still going to do business the same way with me at Euro Pacific Capital. You can't close your account and bring your account to Euro Pacific International because Euro Pacific International is not going to accept Americans as customers. Just like Euro Pacific Capital in America is not going to accept foreigners as customers anymore. Right now we do, but we're going to stop doing that. And I'm going to segment my customer base between U.S. and non-U.S.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah, okay, next up, this will be the last call of the night, Rob in Virginia. Go ahead, Rob.
Hello, Peter.
Hi.
I got a question for you. I've read all your books, and I'm a big fan of you and your company. My question is this. To what level do you think dollars going to fall when people are going to start looking at it at a critical time? Would be thinking 70, 69 in that area?
Well, I said earlier in the show when I wrote Crash Proof, my ultimate target for the dollar index was 40. And, you know, right now it's at 77.5. I actually think 40 is, you know, I think that's a best case scenario. I think the dollar is probably going to go a lot lower than that, the dollar index. I mean, we have made so many mistakes. But the thing is, other countries are making a lot of mistakes too. I mean, that's why, you know, I've been saying I thought gold was going to go to 5,000 an ounce. You know, I kind of think that it's probably going to get closer to 10,000 by the time it's over. And of course, if we have hyperinflation, you know, it'll be a lot higher than that.
Okay. Well, thank you for taking my call. I appreciate it, Peter.
All right, thanks for calling. Anyway, so that's it. Let me just kind of wrap this up. But first of all, of course, everything that I say in this show, where I think the dollar's going, where I think gold's going, these are all my own opinions. There's no guarantees here. Anyway, so make sure that you understand the risks and before you make any investments. You know, it's totally possible that I'm wrong, right? The dollar is really safe, that quantitative easing is exactly what we need, that we just need to print a lot of money, and if we print enough money, well, we'll have economic growth, we'll create jobs, and Ben Bernanke knows exactly what he's doing. Despite the fact that he's been wrong so many times, he could nail it now. He could be completely right. So, you know, so be careful before you decide what you want to do. But if you want to explore some of these opportunities and you're willing to assume the risks, you know, call up the Euro Pacific Capital, 800-727-7922, 800-727-7922, to talk to one of the representatives about how you can use foreign stocks and bonds, precious metals, to hedge yourself against this dollar destruction, to try to avoid being a casualty of the currency war. Also, if you want to get physical precious metals, delivered to your house, my new company, Europac Metals, is up and running, and business is very brisk. The number there is 888 465-3160. It's actually 888-GOLD-160, 888-GOLD-160, which is 888-465-3160. Also, if you haven't read Crash Proof, make sure and pick up a copy of 2.0, and definitely How an Economy Grows and Why It Crashes, or the little book. I am beginning to negotiate on it, my next book, which might come out sometime in 2012. It's going to be more of a comprehensive book, not only explaining what the problems are, but outlining in-depth, detailed solutions of what we need to do across the board. And I'm going to tackle a host of subjects. It should be by far the biggest, most comprehensive book that I have written, and hopefully it will get the attention it deserves. You know, none of my other books have been reviewed by anybody. I mean, no newspapers, no book reviewers have ever reviewed a single book that I've written, despite the fact that they've been New York Times bestsellers. My books have sold strictly on word of mouth, without any advertising, paid advertising, without any reviews. It's kind of a shame. But anyway, hopefully the next one will get some. But don't forget, next week, the last episode of Wall Street Unspun. It should be an interesting, and it was an interesting experience for me. And I, you know, maybe some people can call in who've been listening from the beginning. If there's anybody who's been listening for that length of time, but it's going to start the new chapter. So don't forget, it's shiftradio.com. Tell your friends, particularly the people in Fairfield County, Connecticut, and Westchester County, New York. I want to make sure that we get a lot of people listening to the radio show, because it's important that this show get a big audience quickly so that we can convince the syndicators to pick it up, or other radio stations to carry the show, so we can spread this message on AM radio throughout the United States. Anyway, again, thank you, everybody. This has been Peter Schiff. You've been listening live to Wall Street Unspun Midweek Market Update. Thanks, everybody, and I will be back again a week from today, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific, for the final episode of Wall Street Unspun. Good night, everybody.